You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this last week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with the Idaho Education News, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Joni Odenland with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
All right. The legislature officially wrapped for the year yesterday, but we do need to talk about what they did in those final days. So, Kevin, let's talk education and what happened in those final days.
Well, really, most of the education stuff, Gemma, was pretty much settled. And, you know, we talked about it earlier this week. A lot of the budgets were pretty much resolved. We saw kind of the final chapter on the K-12 budgets and the higher education budgets. Really, that was all kind of crafted out in the past couple of weeks. What it really came down to late on Friday, and Clark and I were there until midnight on Friday last week, and it had to do with libraries and the library budget. And this goes back to this long debate that we saw this legislative session about concerns about pornography and obscenity in the libraries and materials accessible to children in the libraries. And we had that House Bill 666, which passed the House and didn't advance in the Senate, that would have basically left librarians and school employees subject to criminal prosecution if they if a child got their hands on harmful or objectionable materials. Mm. That never passed, but the debate over obscene materials in the libraries continued, and it really kind of played out in the battle over the budget. And this is a small budget. I mean, this is it started out as an $11 million budget. It wound up about $7 million compared to the big money topics we were talking about in education. This isn't a lot of money, but it was a very emotional debate and kind of the culture war of this legislative session.
And also, Kevin, we'll get back to the library in a moment, but let's talk about higher ed for a minute, because, last year, so much was cut from higher ed. And all of a sudden, I think some surprising things happened.
Well, a couple of surprising things happened. First of all, the higher education budget passed the House on the first shot. You know, you go back to the past two legislative sessions, you've had bitter fights on the House floor. You've had the House vote down versions of the higher education budget, forcing the budget committee to go back and rewrite the budget, exactly what they did this year with the library's budget. I mean, that's the whole drama that we saw this session. But this time around, the higher education budget passed the first time. We're talking about an increase in general fund dollars that is probably the largest in state history. I can't go all the way back to statehood and get you a number, but the 25 or so million dollars of new general fund money, tax money, going into higher education, that is probably a single year record. And what it boils down to, if you're an employee in higher education, you're in line to get a 5% pay raise. They've got a 5% raise to divvy up on the campuses. And what it means for students is, if you're an Idaho student, an undergrad, attending one of the four-year schools in Idaho, you will see a tuition freeze for the third consecutive year. The presidents have said this budget will allow them to fund the pay raises, fund operations, and not have to increase tuition.
And that's huge. I mean, that is...
If you're a parent or a student, yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah,
and that was one of the arguments on the House floor, is if we can freeze tuition in a time of high inflation, we're protecting our students and parents from another increase when they're already dealing with a higher cost of living on just about everything else.
Right, absolutely. Okay, let's dig a little bit deeper into library funding, especially for people who may not know the full history behind this. So, Clark, I know both you and Kevin have been covering this, and as Kevin mentioned, both of you were at the State House until midnight last Friday. Get us updated on why this became such a big deal.
Gemma, this was one of the most surprising aspects of the legislative session to me, to see this attack on libraries and to see the way particularly some conservative Republicans in the Idaho House of Representatives handled it. But Kevin's exactly right. And I mean, I think Kevin was really right that education was one of the bright spots of this legislative session that got overshadowed by some of these divisive debates that we're about to get into talking about the library situation. But it all started a few weeks ago with that House Bill 666, that kind of oddly named bill, House Bill 666, that, like Kevin said, it would have removed protections, not just for librarians, but for employees of museums, of schools, of colleges and universities, protections that are in state law now that basically would protect them from prosecution if materials that were quote unquote harmful to minors, you know, were accessible to children. And so, like Kevin said, that bill passed the Idaho House, but that was one of several bills that the House passed that the Idaho Senate never touched, didn't want anything to do with this year. That was another theme from the session. And I think that bothered some Republicans in the Idaho House. And then so flash forward to last Friday night, it actually even started on Thursday before that. But when the Idaho Commission for Libraries budget came up, House Republicans, in particular, I'm thinking of Representative Julianne Young, who's a Republican from Blackfoot, and Representative Dan DeMordant, who's a Republican from Eagle, they used the public opposition that some librarians and Library Association members gave in opposition, expressing concerns with that House Bill 666. And then Representative Young used that in her debate on one of the Library Commission budgets that was killed, saying, "I found the librarians to be unprofessional. I found this to be, quite frankly, unfundable," is what Representative Young said. And then immediately, two different legislators, one Democrat, one Republican, both stood up and said, "Hey, we have a real problem with this line of debate because you're taking the First Amendment rights that Idahoans have to come and testify to the legislature, to express their concerns with policy proposals, and you're using it against them while we cut their budget." And so both Representative Ruckte, who's a Democrat from Pocatello, and Representative Cheney, who's a Republican from Caldwell area, said, "Hey, this is, you know, reasonable minds can disagree, and we don't have to call people unprofessional, and we don't have to reduce their funding." And so they were very concerned about that. And like Kevin said, what ended up happening at the end of the day is the Library Commission budget went from about an $11.2 million budget to a $7.7 million budget. And it was weird how we got there. It took five versions of the budget to finally get passed just before midnight last Friday. They cut $3.5 million. And they took out our friend Melissa Davlin, actually, from Idaho Public Television, Idaho Reports, had a really good story on her blog about what the $3.5 million would have gone to. And it was technology grants that could have been used to access telehealth services for library patrons in rural Idaho libraries. And so that's where the money that was cut would have gone. And then the last thing that finally broke it loose was they cut another $100 from the library budget and then passed it just before midnight Friday. And that really wrapped up all the legislative business. They did take a recess to see if the governor was going to veto any bills. He did. But when we came back Thursday of this week, the last day of the legislative session, it was really calm and not very dramatic compared to the rest of the session. The Senate tried to override one of the vetoes and failed. The House didn't even touch any of the vetoes. So Thursday was much more calm, but really the divisive stuff played out late last week, and then they wrapped up their business very, very late on Friday.
And Gemma,
so go ahead, Kevin.
To kind of put these budget cuts into a little bit of perspective, because Clark really explained what happened with the library budget well, but I want to kind of take a little step back here. So a year ago, when we were talking about the higher education budget and the legislature cut $2.5 million out of that budget, that's $2.5 million out of a higher education budget. That's about $600 million when you factor in the state tax dollars and the money that the universities and college get from tuition and fees. So $2.5 million out of $600 million, you know, that's money. I'm not trying to downplay it, but I'm trying to put it into perspective. $3.5 million out of a library budget, that's $11 million. That's a big chunk of the budget. Now, it was federal money. It was for these telehealth programs, like Clark said. So it was one time, but that's still a large chunk of money. And these are telehealth programs that have nothing to do with purported smut in the libraries. The only thing they have in common is that they would have been under the same roof. You would have been able to get to the telehealth programs at the same public library that allegedly has this objectionable material that kids can access when nobody's looking. Yeah, so it really doesn't connect.
It sounds like we're going to take a break in a second, but Kevin's right. The Library Commission budget is 10% less than what it was set at last year. And that's really almost shocking considering the state was in a position at the beginning of the year with a record surplus of projected at $1.9 billion with a B dollars. And the legislature cut the Library Commission budget by, I think, 10% compared to the current level. And so that's really surprising and unusual.
Well, what I find interesting about this, Kevin and Clark, is that you're right, Kevin, where, you know, they it's like the legislature makes a statement by cutting the budget, similar to what they did last year with higher education budgets and the so-called CRT. And now with this alleged, you know, pornography that children have access to, they're making a statement by cutting the budget. Yet what they're doing is cutting access to healthcare to people who live in rural communities.
Right. And that was the point that Democrats on the budget committee tried to make, and they were outnumbered, you know, in the motions and in saying, you know, especially in the past 2 years, especially during the pandemic, rural libraries have been this really important access point for people to get online, to get information that they need online. And you're cutting off access at a really inopportune time. That was their argument. And it didn't go very far in committee. It didn't go very far on the floor of the House and the Senate either.
Joni, you wrote an article recently in regards to elected officials, but also people that are running for office and the harassment that they face. Can you talk to us about this? I mean, this is something that we have seen pick up since the pandemic. I mean, the one that I think so many of us remember vividly that went national was when former Ada County Commissioner Diana Lacciando was in a meeting and she had to get up from it and leave because she was at her office. Her children were home and there were people outside the home screaming, yelling, bullhorns, and her, you know, basically harassing her children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gemma. And it seems that since that event happened, that these kinds of events are becoming more and more common with elected officials in the Treasure Valley in Idaho. In general, my reporting kind of started off with one of Lacciando's former fellow commissioners, Kendra Kenyon, who announced last month that she was not going to seek a second term on the Ada County Commission, partially because of the harassment that she's gotten while in office. She's the lone Democrat currently on the commission. And she was telling me just about the barrage of, you know, nasty emails, Facebook comments, Facebook posts she gets in relation to her job every day. Of course, Ada County's had a couple of really high profile votes in recent months, the first being for the Ada County Sheriff, and the second being for the appointment of Dr. Ryan Cole to the Central District Health Board, which of course she was the lone vote against for Ada County. And that's something we're seeing kind of across the board. I also spoke to former Idaho Secretary of State candidate Chad Houck, who told me that he was interested in becoming Secretary of State, but decided against it because of hate mail that he was getting. He had a package of shredded campaign materials that was sent to his home. And this is all because people said he didn't have a strong enough opinions against claims of election fraud that were reported by former President Donald Trump, which of course aren't true, but we're widely perceived to be true, and we're kind of seen as the requirement for any sort of Republican candidate for Idaho Secretary of State. And we're seeing, I was speaking to some Idaho Democratic leadership, and they were saying that it's becoming increasingly hard for Idaho Democrats to find candidates for these positions, to find candidates for local office, for precinct judges. You can kind of see that in their most recent filings, actually, in the race to replace Kendra Kenyon, we only have one Democrat currently running for that position, Patricia Nielsen, and you have against three Republicans. So it seems that it's becoming a lot less likely for Democrats who might feel a little more threatened in this environment to want to do that. I should say that most of these have been from far right groups that are sending these types of threats for sure. And I'm sure Kevin can also speak to the threats that school board members have faced recently too. We have a number of school board members in Nampa and West Ada who have also resigned or said they won't seek re-election because of, you know, threats they get over vaccine mandates, mask mandates, even before they've been passed, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and however, with all of this being said, I mean, we do know, Joni, that some of these threats have prompted changes in some policy, but only on a local level. So, like, for example, talk a little bit about what the city of Boise has decided to do because of the level of threats that elected officials are receiving.
Yeah, I should say the city of Boise hasn't really specified kind of what threats they've gotten, but, you know, Mayor Laura McLean of Boise and a couple of city councilors have said that they have gotten credible threats against their lives while serving in office. And part of the reaction to that is, well, one, you'll see, if you ever see the mayor in public, you'll know that she has a bodyguard that follows her around at all times, which wasn't always the case. And now the policy is if they take a trip, or this is for any city employee, this isn't even just for elected officials, but for any city employee in Boise, if they are going to travel for a conference or just outside of Boise on taxpayer dime, the location of where they're traveling and the purpose for that travel is kept essentially secret until they return from the trip. They've cited part of Idaho law that says it's critical infrastructure that it would put them at undue risk to release this information to the public because there's a fear that their movements can be tracked and someone would try to make some sort of attempt on their lives. I personally, the statesman kind of questions as to whether or not that's actually a good excuse to keep this information secret, but it does still speak to the point that this is something that they are concerned about because they do get these sorts of threats on a regular basis.
Well, and it's gotten to the point where I mean, this is completely out of the norm. And you even have talked about that in your articles, Joni. But I want to bring in Kevin and Clark into this conversation because I believe last legislative session, there was a bill trying to be passed to make it illegal to protest outside of someone's home. And then wasn't this picked up again before the end of the session, Clark or Kevin? I mean, where did we leave all of this?
Yeah, Gemma, that's exactly right. There was a bipartisan effort during last year's legislative session between Representative Greg Cheney, a Republican, and Representative Brooke Green, a Democrat, to push forward legislation that would address this residential targeted picketing and protesting. It didn't pass last year. It ran into concerns. I think a couple of the opposition concerns were if somebody's doing something illegal, we may already have laws on the books to address this. There were also concerns about people's First Amendment rights to silently or peacefully protest. And so the bill didn't advance last year. It was a similar bill was introduced at the very end of this legislative session. It didn't have time to advance either. I think sometimes when you see those bills, and Ken can jump in, but introduced late at the session, it's to have the conversation keep going. It's to keep the discussion alive, even if it isn't about the ultimate goal of you know, passing a new law or passing a policy change. And so it's something that there is bipartisan support that legislators have been looking at, have been having this conversation. And yeah, it's like Joni was saying in their reporting, it's happening at the local level. It's happening with city council, with county commission. It's happening with library boards and school boards. And it's happening all the way up at the Idaho legislature, where we are seeing really more often than not, it's these far right groups that go out and protest, like the protest at former Commissioner Lachiando's house, the protests at Representative Cheney's family's home last year, where actually a group of people brought pitchforks and hanged a stuffed animal in effigy with the Cheney name on a t-shirt, just kind of ugly stuff that we're seeing all throughout the state at all different levels of government. But I'll see if Kevin or Joni had any other thoughts on policy changes to try to address this.
Well, and I think it's important. Kevin, can I just jump in for a minute? Because I also think it's important to note that you can put judges in this. I mean, for example, what happened with Judge Fortier, who is a fourth magistrate judge, just in the last couple of weeks. I mean, doxing with her home address, with her VIN number, because of a ruling that she made in a court case. I mean, so Kevin, this is getting to the point where, I mean, it's infiltrating our justice system.
And it's affecting all levels of government. I mean, to Joni's point before, the bill that was presented towards the end of this legislative session that didn't go anywhere, that I think was probably there partly to keep the conversation going. One of the folks who supported it was Amy Johnson, who had been a trustee in the West Ada District. Mm-hmm. She stepped down a couple of months ago, frustrated with the level of acrimony that she had been dealing with as a trustee. So, again, you've got elected officials, at all levels of government who are dealing with this and are concerned with it.
I should make the point too that it's not just Democrats that are facing this too. It's a lot of Republicans, as Clark said before. I spoke to Senator Pro Tem Chuck Winder, who said that he last summer had to deal with anti-vaccine protesters knocking at his door, and that he says this sort of increasingly violent and or just interrogative approach that some are taking to protesting, it has him and a lot of other of his colleagues concerned, and that they've all acknowledged that they're becoming targets. And he said he even notices when in committee people will bring firearms into these meetings or around the Capitol, kind of as a way of intimidation. I guess they have taken kind of steps against that, but. He said that that sort of soft intimidation is sort of felt by him and other members of the body for sure.
Well, and it is one of these things where I think it's important to note that everyone has a right to protest. That is part of our Constitution. You have a right to do that, but I think it becomes questionable when people's safety is put on the line, when people's children are brought into it, when people are doxxed. That is where we get into muddy waters, at least in my opinion, as we watch all of this play out.
Yeah,
I think you're actually right.
Yeah, and just one thing I want to touch on again, if I haven't already, is just that the reverberation of this, you're going to have a lot less people that are willing to deal with that when running for office.
Exactly.
I mean, people in Democrats, Republicans, people from all parties are saying that more and more people are more hesitant to run for office, not just because you're putting yourself out there in a public space to be judged by voters, but because there's the perception that your actual physical safety might be in jeopardy at some point. And for some people, that's not a calculated risk worth making.
And when we look a lot of these officials, like our school board members, these are unpaid volunteers who live in the local community and usually get involved because they're asked to help out, or they want to help out, or they have children or grandchildren in the district. But school board members and so many of these officials are unpaid volunteers when we're talking about school board members. And I can't even imagine the pressure that they've been under the last 2 years with the pandemic and health and safety concerns. And then throw on top of that the fact that you may have an angry mob gathering outside your home with torches and pitchforks, yelling and screaming, and there's children around. I mean, absolutely, this is a dark chapter here that we're looking at that goes way beyond just the ability for the, in my opinion, goes way beyond the ability for the public to peacefully protest. But yeah, school board members are unpaid volunteers, and they're putting up, shouldering a lot of this.
And even before the pandemic, Clark and I have written this story so many times over the past few years, even before the pandemic, a lot of school districts around the state, especially in small communities, were practically begging for people to serve as trustees. I mean, these are not political springboard positions very often. I mean, they're you know, it's kind of a labor of love for a lot of folks who serve as trustees. They give a lot of their time, they don't get any money for it. And now, you know, you layer in the events of the past 2 years, the pandemic, having to respond now to learning loss issues, and you have this level of public scrutiny, to put it in the most neutral term. Yeah, it's got to be even harder now for school districts to find people who are willing to serve.
It's a level of vitriol that I don't think that we have ever seen. And it is, frankly, disappointing. It is disappointing to think and see that people find it okay to have this type of behavior. So, Kevin, I know we've officially wrapped up the legislative session, but do talk about insurance that the legislature passed for school employees. Tell us about this, because there could be some possible hiccups.
Yes, yeah, so now that the session is over, the job that we have now as reporters is to figure out, especially in education, how is all of this going to work? And how is this all going to be implemented at the local level? And Blake Jones did a really nice job for us the other day writing about the insurance issue. Now, we've talked about this before. The legislature put a lot of money into insurance benefits for school employees this year. They put $75 million of one-time money into a pot that districts can use to move their insurance plans under the state insurance plan, which is kind of the gold standard of insurance plans for public employees. It's what state employees are on. And some school districts are already on it, but not all. So the hope is that by putting this money in, more districts will be able to tap into the state plan. And now on top of that, you've got $105 million a year that the legislature is committed to putting into any kind of insurance plan that a district decides to purchase for their employees. Because right now, the state's not putting in nearly as much money for school employee benefits as they are for state employee benefits. So anyway, fast forward to where we are now and Blake's story from Thursday. It's not clear how many districts are going to go into the state plan, because it's still pretty costly to do that. Buying into the plan, it's expensive. And there are questions about whether this $75 million will be enough to help districts, you know, take their share of money and go onto the state plan. There are questions about, does this plan really cover every employee? It really doesn't. What it does is it covers some school employees that are actually get their salary from the state, as opposed to positions that school districts are funding through other means. So it gets complicated, but the bottom line is there's a lot more money going to employee benefits, and school officials are saying that's a good thing. We'll be able to do better for our employees one way or the other. It's not clear how many of them will go into the state plan as opposed to shopping around for a little bit better plan for their employees. Mm-hmm.
Joni, talk to us about an article that you recently wrote in regards to a high-profile shooting that happened in Boise. And these are reports that the Office of Police Accountability did, but they weren't released to the public?
Yeah, just for some background. So last year, the city of Boise created a new Office of Police Accountability. It was created by a city ordinance. And the idea being that it would be a kind of citizen, you know, non-law enforcement led oversight board that could independently investigate police shootings or other complaints against officers at Boise Police. And to see if there really was any misconduct in this incident. And this includes the number of police shootings that we saw in Boise last year, quite a high number than what we're used to. I think it was like five or something. And that includes the shooting of Muhammad Makoma, who was a Somali Bantu refugee, or is. He was shot 20 times by Boise police officers last year after allegedly kidnapping his 13-year-old son. This all came up because the director, Jesus Sara, was given a presentation before the Boise City Council on Tuesday when he mentioned that his office has recently completed about six reports into different shootings dating back to 2016. And then, you know, come to find out that these reports have been released months ago, some of them as far back as December, for these high-profile shootings, but they had not been announced to the public. You know, we in the media were not made aware of their publication. And when I asked him about that, he said that that was quite literally the intention, that they did not want to make a news item out of these, that if someone wanted to find them, that they could find them for themselves, and that it was not the intention either then or in the future to make them available to the media via a news release. And also, if you were to read these reports, they're quite vague. They don't mention any names. They don't mention places most of the times. They might say like a gas station in Northwest Boise, and they don't mention dates. So instead of saying like July 2021, they might say the summer of 2021. So it can make it really hard to know exactly which shooting you're even talking about, especially considering that some of these shootings are getting 5-6 years old at this point. I mean, it took us quite a while to figure out what exactly they were even talking about. And when I asked him about that, he said that that's part of the city ordinance, that the ordinance requires them to not name any identifying details that could sort of distinguish which shooting or which person you are talking about in these, which kind of raised the question about just how accountable this process really is. And I know that was a concern raised by many others as well, just how different is this than previous efforts by the city of Boise to actually have some sort of citizen oversight to hold officers accountable if indeed they do mess up in the field.
And what was the response when you asked that question?
When I asked them about, yeah, when I asked them, that the idea was that they are vague. I mean, I asked him, would this make it kind of hard to know about which case you're talking about? He's like, that's the idea. We don't want people to know. I think the exact quote was, we don't want people to know about these cases. That's the idea, it's to protect identity, which again raises all kinds of transparency questions. And I'm sure, you know, regular listeners will be familiar. The city of Boise is no stranger to, you know, transparency issues. It's been kind of a recurring theme the past few months, it seems. But I should say that since the publication of the article on Wednesday, the city has said that it will in the future now release these reports to the media. But of course, it still raises the question of exactly, you know, how helpful they are. I should say that with the report from Mohammed Makoma did find that two of the four officers who were present at the scene did not turn on their body cameras, but still found that they were within their right to use deadly force on him.
Mm-hmm. Right. It almost raises more questions than it answers, Joni. I mean, that's what it seems to be doing, frankly.
Yeah. I definitely agree. I don't know if we get a clear sense as to why this was the decision in the first place, because when this was created, one of the stated goals of this new Office of Police Accountability was to, again, increase accountability, increase transparency, because previously you had a similarly titled Office of Police Oversight that was with someone who was not a full-time employee of the city, who published reports that were honestly even more vague than the ones we're seeing right now. And now it just raises the question of like, well, how much more transparent is this really if one, these are mandated vague reports that two aren't even being informed to the public. We're not even still sure if Macomb's family was even made aware of this report when it was released. I can't say honestly at this point.
So, Clark, some big changes could be coming to JFAC and the legislature in 2023, and this is because of retirements, elections, and redistricting. So talk to us about all of this, because when we say big changes, I mean, potentially, I mean, what, for at least a decade, right, when we look at redistricting at least.
Absolutely right, Gemma. Thanks for bringing this up. I had an article in the Idaho Capital Sun the other day looking at all the changes that we're going to see with the 2023 legislature. And you're exactly right. It's all these things kind of coming together all at once. It's the redistricting process where we redraw political boundaries that wrapped up last year. That happens once every 10 years. It's the elections. It's retirements. And just to give you a sense, like in the House, we've got 70 members. We're looking at 10 members retiring, another 9 leaving the House to run for a different office. And I think at least 4, maybe even 6 legislators facing off against each other in contested primary elections in May because of redistricting. And what I did is I took a look at JFAC. That's the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. It's basically the legislature's budget committee that meets first thing every morning and actually goes through and sets each individual component of the state's budget, which is something like $4.5 billion now. And this is really one of those committees where they work hard and experience matters. But both on the House side, both of the top two members of JFAC are retiring. That's Representative Rick Youngblood and Representative Caroline Nielsen-Troy. You've also got Senator Mark Nye, a Democrat, retiring, several other members that could be in contested elections or facing primaries. And so I think the bottom line for JFAC is, depending on how the elections go, this is a 20-member committee, and we know there's going to be at least four changes, but there could be as many as 15 new people out of the 20 on JFAC next year, depending on how the elections go. And I think that's kind of going to generally be a theme for the legislature. We're going to see it in the House. We're going to see it in the Senate. We know there's going to be new leadership in the House with Scott Bedke leaving the legislature to run for higher office, to run for lieutenant governor. And I actually talked with Representative Greg Cheney. He's one of the House members who is leaving the House to run for a seat in the Idaho Senate next year. And he was saying to me, we talked last Friday late at night before they went at recess late last Friday night. He said he's expecting that potentially the highest turnover in state history with the legislature could be next year. And that's important for a lot of different reasons. But Representative Cheney told me that really there's an opportunity to set the tone around decorum and respect or not. He said, with so many new members, we have an opportunity to have the people who stay around focus on respect and decorum and civility. But if not, he's concerned that the legislature could continue kind of down a dark path. He talked about how difficult 2020 and 2021 were for the legislature, between the interruptions that we saw in 2020 and the protest, the ethics hearings in 2021, where we had a member accused of raping a teenage intern, and that former legislator is on trial and has pleaded not guilty. We had a second ethics hearing, which was particularly divisive and difficult, where Representative Priscilla Giddings, Republican from Whitebird, was censured by the House for promoting a blog that identified the name and photo of the teenage intern who accused the former legislator of rape. That's someone we all refer to as Jane Doe. Professional reporters do not identify alleged victims of sexual assault. But in this case, Representative Priscilla Giddings was censured for that. And that was an extremely dark, difficult time for the House. And so Representative Cheney said, with all these changes, it's really coming to kind of a crossroads. You know, what kind of a state government, what kind of a legislative branch are we going to have with so many new members? So he said, for the members that are sticking around, including some of the rookies from this year, it's going to be up to them to set this tone, stand up for respect and civility and decorum, and try to do away with some of the divisiveness and some of the attacks and the yelling and the name calling and some of the difficult and divisive moments that we've seen. And so I think that's why, you know, the state house is going to be quiet with the session adjourning, but our political season is just heating up. As Kevin and Joni, and as you know, Gemma, we're just 6.5 weeks away from those primary elections. Those are May 17th. Every seat in the legislature this year is up for election. All the big statewide offices, including things like governor and lieutenant governor, school superintendent, attorney general. One of our U.S. Senate seats is up for election. And I think both of our U.S. House seats in Congress are up for election. And so these elections, I know we've talked about this for weeks now, probably even months, but it's really going to go a long way to shaping our Idaho government probably for the next 10 years. And that's why these elections are really, really important this year. And there's a lot going on with retirements and redistricting. So it's a fascinating time, but I know all the reporters in Idaho really have their work cut out for themselves over the next 6-7 weeks here.
Yeah, even though the legislative session wrapped up, you know, it doesn't feel like anything's slowing down. You know, Kevin and Clark, I'm curious to know what your takeaways are from this year's session before we wrap up today. And Kevin, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it's a lot of what we talked about before. I mean, this is a big year for education on a lot of fronts. But you also, well, I think this was a maybe more efficient session in some ways and maybe a little bit less strident in some areas. You still had a lot of that, you know, that cultural divide that we've talked about in the legislature embodied in the debate over libraries and the debate over the abortion law that went into effect. Yeah. And who knows what we're going to be looking at next year? I mean, Clark, you know, focused on JFAC, and JFAC is really important. What happens in that budget committee and who's new on the budget committee is a big deal. We're going to have at least 36 new legislators next year out of 105. I mean, that's the minimum. And that assumes that there are no upsets in the primary or in the general election. And we know we'll have that, but we're going to have at least 12 new senators, and some of them may be former House members moving over to the Senate, 24 new House members. You know, what we saw this year could be very different next year, or it could be more of the same, depending on how some of these elections shake out.
And Clark, we have about 2 minutes left, so if I could get your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I really agree with Kevin. I think that when you look at Governor Brad Little, when you look at House leadership, there were a lot of things that they were happy with this year. Largest tax cut in state history. Granted, it was an income tax cut and not a property tax reduction. Historic investments in education. We didn't really talk much about public school funding this year. I think that was a real bright spot. Probably mm-hmm. the largest investment in K-12 public schools. That's more money for literacy in grades kindergarten through third grade. That's basically 2 years of raises for public school teachers and a $1,000 bonus on top of that for public school employees. The state was able to pay down some debt, was able to spend some of the surplus money on one-time investments on things like roads and bridges and infrastructure projects. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of that got overshadowed by some of these divisive debates over the elections bills that I was talking about several weeks ago on Idaho Matters. Those were a lot of bills that the Idaho House passed that the Idaho Senate did not take up. But between the elections bills, the abortion bill, the debate over libraries, I think a lot of divisiveness overshadowed some of the accomplishments that were made. And so I think that's kind of where I'm thinking, you know, still a lot of really close to the session. It just adjourned yesterday for us. And so mm-hmm. haven't really had time.
It's all pretty raw here, you know.
Pretty raw is what I'm trying to say.
You do need to process.
Take a little time to process, but some real policy accomplishments, particularly on education. A lot of Republicans will campaign on the tax cuts and paying down debt. Yeah. But still a pretty short, intense, divisive session for a lot of Idahoans, I would say.
Well, as always, I want to thank all of you for the work that you do. Big thanks to Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Jody Onland with the Idaho Statesman. Coming up on Monday here on Idaho Matters, well, as we mentioned, the legislature wrapped up and they went home. But what did they get done? We're going to take a deep dive for you. So that's Monday at noon. Guys, thanks so much. Appreciate your time, Kevin and Clark and Joni. Thank you.
Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Gemma.
And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our executive producer is Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. Have a really good weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.